Broadcasting live from beautiful, historic Marion, Ohio, it's Now with Scott Spears on WWGH 107.1 FM. Call Scott live on the air anytime at 740-383-9944. No topic is too big or too small. I'm your announcer, the man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. And now, here's your host, Scott Spears.
Thank you, man with the golden voice, Ted Williams. Scott Spears coming at you live here on a Wednesday morning, April the 28th. 2021, 18 and a half minutes past the hour, and we've got a great show for you this morning. Let me give you a quick update here. Tomorrow on the program from 8:10 until 9 a.m. live, we're going to be joined by legendary ABC newsman Sam Donaldson, who will be on tomorrow to talk about everything that's been going on in the world, current event-wise, in about the last month. Coming up in hour number two today, we're going to be joined by legendary comedian Shecky Green, who just turned 95. Now, Shecky is a regular visitor to this program. He has not been on since election night 2020. Now, this morning, he is going to reveal for the first time why he has not been on since election night. So stay tuned for that. I know a lot of people have requested his return to the show, and this morning we will have that. In hour number one here, we're joined by a gentleman we've had on before, but what an interesting time to have him on with the current event situation in the world, from the George Floyd trial to what happened right here in Columbus, Ohio, with 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant, and a lot of it happening in the courtroom with police officers, and race being a key word in a lot of these trials and cases. He is the best-known defense attorney, possibly, in the United States, maybe the world. You probably remember him best representing Sam Shepard here in Ohio, or O.J. Simpson. A pleasure to welcome to these microphones for hour number one this morning, as it always has been, F. Lee Bailey. Mr. Bailey, how are you?
I'm just fine, thank you.
Want to start off here in the beginning. The George Floyd trial. Can you give us your thoughts on that trial in general?
Well, you know, it was used as a whipping tool, not surprisingly. We all saw the video of the knee on the neck, and that was enough to hate the police officer right there because it was so prolonged. But when it came around to putting proper legal labels on it, I think there was some fumbling, and perhaps the worst part is that the public was conditioned to believe that the conviction of this officer would atone for all the abuse that was going on, black and white, police and citizen around the country, and it simply wasn't the right vehicle for that.
Why was it not the right vehicle?
Because, first of all, it was an aberration. How many times in my lifetime have I watched a policeman abuse an arrested person for 9 minutes and 29 seconds? Never, nor have you, nor any of your viewers. It's brand new on the scene. What do we do on that besides revile the police officer and make sure that he pays a heavy penalty? And how in the world does that make better some of the atrocious conduct that appears to be going on in North Carolina, and yet the unwarranted blame heaped on the officer in Columbus, Ohio? You can't put these all in a lump and say good and bad because they are essentially apples and oranges, which have never made a good stew.
What do you think happened with George Floyd and Chauvin, the officer? When we see that video, what do you see?
Well, I think it's fairly obvious that the officer was poorly trained and probably poorly screened, should not have been a policeman. I think that he came into the picture believing at least that Floyd was a doper and under the influence, in essence, a second-grade citizen who didn't really have to be given a whole lot of concern. When he put his knee on his neck, I doubt that he ever had the intent that it would take his life. What he may have had is a reckless disregard, which is Well, I don't know if it's going to take his life, but I really don't give a damn. That is a substitute for intent. And I think that should have been the focus of the issue put to the jury, to suggest that he ever thought, well, I'd like to murder this guy in front of an international TV audience for constant replay is simply not going anywhere, doesn't make any sense, and doesn't help us get to the major issue. How in the world do we stop shooting each other? Policeman, citizen, and citizen to citizen, frankly.
A major point in this trial was race. If George Floyd had been a white man with all the same characteristics, would that have happened?
You know, that's a burning question that was isolated years ago by John Grisham, the famed author of legal stories, in a book that didn't sell called The Time to Kill. When he became popular, it became a bestseller, front-running movie, and it involved a black man who shot two white boys in a courthouse who had raped and killed his daughter. And the defense lawyer said to the jury, at the end of his argument, would your verdict be the same if she had been white? And the jury acquitted. That's kind of the picture here. Did Floyd get different treatment because he was black? I think you have to say probably, because I think too many people are disciplined when they're brought up, or at least encouraged to believe that Asians or blacks or other minority groups in this country are inferior. And, you know, that was the whole bedrock philosophy of the Ku Klux Klan, and it's still around and alive out there today in various iterations. I have to believe the policeman just didn't care much about black people. And yes, that was a factor in his decision not to remove his knee.
Was it the pandemic? Was it the timing? Was it the case? Was it the video? What made this an instance where people went out and some rioted, some protested, and this case was covered on national television? What made this important, a man that was not a celebrity?
I think two things brought this case to prominence and gave it a very strong and vibrant life, to use a metaphor. Number one, the unrest in this country and the clashes between law enforcement and its constituents has been a rampant and difficult issue now for several years during the Trump administration, especially number two, the outrage that was impossible to avoid as you watch the video over and over again, and we did, was how in the world did he manage to keep his knee there for 9 minutes and 29 seconds and not care about the guy on the ground? And the answer is, I think primarily, this guy on the ground was a second-class citizen, and you don't have to care a lot about them. On the other hand, I think the balance of the question, why did he do it, is one that he himself would have trouble answering.
In the past, it has been very hard in a lot of people's minds to convict a police officer. A lot of people went back to Rodney King. There was a lot of talk of that trial during this particular incident. Why is it more difficult, even when there's video, for a police officer to be convicted of a crime?
Well, number one, society generally and the culture in recent years, again, because of the Trump dominance, is very much aligned with law enforcement and against individual rights, and has been out of balance, I think, in a very evident way that's alarmed a lot of people. So the have-nots were waiting for an opportunity to really show that a policeman is a bad person, which is unfortunate. They're not bad people. They take big risks. They're underpaid, undertrained, and selected at times when they should not have been qualified to have that authority, and particularly the authority to physically abuse and otherwise weaponize their disagreements with the general constituency. But a policeman probably will always be in a society set apart somewhat from the citizens. He's got to police. I don't know any way around that, but I think it's got to be attenuated with better communications, understanding, and so forth. That's a big program. That's not one you're going to shove down society's throat based on an aberration like the case in Minneapolis.
When we look at police officers in general, another question out of this trial was, as we talked earlier, is it race, or are police officers just not getting the training they need? We see the case with a police officer pulling out a gun when she says she wanted to go for a taser. Are people becoming police officers now that maybe should not be, or maybe not getting the proper training?
Well, I think there have always been people who became police officers who should never have been allowed to qualify in the first place. It takes a considerably balanced person to have the restraint to be less than abusive and nonetheless to do your job right and offer good protection to the weak and the downtrodden, as they're so often called, and correctly so. I don't think that dichotomy can ever be totally melded so that we have parties on the street corner on Saturday night with the cops as a regular thing. But I think we could be more civil to one another if there were better training. Yes, the training is inadequate, and let me give you what I think is a good, solid example. I am, at least at the beginning, a product of the military. I was a Marine in the Korean War, a jet fighter pilot, very much aligned with the government and a fairly conservative society, and we were disciplined. We were cops. We were international cops. We would not think of breaking the rules the way that some local officers do. However, our training was far superior. Our selection process was much elevated from what it takes to be, initially at least, a uniformed police officer here. And I think if the model of military training and discipline, which has straightened out an awful lot of guys that I've represented that would have spent life in prison, had it not been for the intervention of that kind of training, I think if that were brought across into the police sector and used as a much higher standard, that although it would take a while and it would take some extra money up front, we would wind up with a more comfortable police-citizen relationship, and God knows we need it.
You've been involved in many high-profile cases, maybe the most high-profile case of all time, the O.J. Simpson trial. Because this was covered in the newspapers every day, in the internet, on the internet, talked about on all cable news, how did that affect the Chauvin trial?
Well, bear in mind that O.J. Simpson was in part a product of resentment by the police over the pasting they had taken in the Rodney King case, much deserved, I would point out. And once again, we had a video of police in groups beating Rodney King with nightsticks when he was unarmed and down. It was brutal, it was disgusting, and they paid a price for it. They still are. A policeman in L.A. is not the kind of guy you'll expect to find in the front office, because they are terribly controversial and have been the subject of management problems for at least 20 or 30 years that I'm aware of. But the backlash, where one case feeds anger, resentment, and residual hatred, as happened in Rodney King, and was taken out on O.J., not by the press, although they became, I think, complicit very quickly, but the police saw an opportunity to deflect attention away from the bad white guy image and put a bad image on a black guy, and they very aggressively did that. Best example, they put the cuffs on O.J. when his lawyer said, are you arresting him? No, we'll take the cuffs off. They put them on as a knee-jerk response, and it was a clue that the O.J. Simpson case was going to be a legal mess, and that's the understatement of the year. It is a legal mess. I've tried to straighten it out after 25 years with a book showing what really happened, and we'll find out whether that has any impact or not, or whether the media have so convinced the public that Simpson is guilty that I can't unravel it even with the truth.
Did you expect that at the time when the verdict came in, that all these years later, as you say, people believe that O.J. was guilty?
I never suspected it. I thought the jury verdict, particularly since it was slam dunk. I mean, my best calculation is that this jury discussed the case in deliberation for something like 53 minutes, and the rest of the 4 hours that the press talks about was used in going back and forth to the courtroom and waiting for lawyers and other people in this molasses process we call a court system. But O.J. has paid a pretty heavy price for that. He managed to get himself in minor trouble in Las Vegas and got treated like he'd committed a capital crime. I have been vilified and abused and defrocked and other things because people who hate me saying you perverted your talents getting that end guy off. And if defense lawyers had to suffer that kind of penalty for getting what was obviously on the evidence the proper result, I think there would be no defense bar. So it's kind of a sad explication. And I think the hair shirt at the end of the day in the O.J. case, because of the wrong attitude arising from the right verdict, has got to be laid at the feet of the press. Most of them couldn't find a criminal case with both hands, if I may use a nice substitute for your derriere, but wrote articles every day as if they had revealed wisdom and were letting the public in on things the jury would never know. And that kind of presumptuous facade has been carried over. I can go up to a fellow who's otherwise pretty sensible in my view and say, what about Simpson? He said, look, we all know he did it. You got him off, so you're a smart ass. That doesn't mean that he's innocent at all. And that attitude's tough to fight because it's circular. You always meet your own tail as you come around the corner.
When we look at race, because it did come up during the Simpson trial, it obviously was a big part of the Floyd trial. It's obviously a big part of what's going on in Columbus right now and other places across the country. Why is race and police officers and court cases, why is this such a big issue constantly?
Well, I think race is just the headliner. There are other hostilities that exist at a group level. Policemen don't have to have a black victim to be abusive. On the other hand, you don't have to have a black police officer to have him wrongly vilified by the people that he's supposed to be protecting. It's something we can't get around for some reason. I mean, this country should be on its knees asking forgiveness for stealing people from their home in another continent, bringing them here, enslaving them, and treating them like dirt. And slowly, they make their way to the surface, and there are still those who would like to push them back under and make them drown. To a lesser extent, that same problem's been visited on Asians, Latinos, all kinds of groups that just don't like one another. And until we learn on this small planet to like one another a little better or to at least be more tolerant of views different than our own, we're going to see these eruptions, outrages, claims of racial misuse all the time. And by the way, as a footnote, I hasten to remind you, Scott, that race was brought into the Simpson case only once and only by one person, by Detective Furman, who's admitted perjury for denying that he used it. He also denies, and then now will not answer the question he takes the fifth, whether he planted the glove, without which this case would never have gone to trial, and the glove was black. But I'm sure it had nothing to do with race at the time that it was submitted to the jury as consideration as an essential link to the murders.
When we will see the Chauvin sentencing, because he's a police officer, because it was a high-profile case, because he was convicted on all three counts, what would you expect the sentencing to be like there?
Well, first of all, the judge, I think, has to get by a major issue, and that is, was his intent ever, or his degree of reckless disregard, ever sufficient to uphold a deliberate homicide conviction? If not, I think the top count, the 40-year count, has probably got to go, and the middle count is shaky. I see nothing that would support an attack on the lowest count, so I think this young man is going to spend a lot of time in prison. The question is, where will they find a prison where he's not going to have a lot of enemies coming in, because policemen are not generally very popular inmates when they arrive after being convicted of criminal conduct. After the judge gets by those issues and imposes sentence, which will be, I think, pretty much aligned with whatever convictions he sees fit to let stick, I think there are going to be some very interesting appellate issues. My friend Alan Dershowitz the other day was on a prominent a podcast about defense lawyers saying there are strong parallels between the Shepard case and the case in Minnesota, and arguably that's so, but there are some strong differences too. The Shepard case and the Minnesota case are both unique. And I say unique being one of a kind, like you, your house, or anything else of which there are no copies. Shepard is the only case in America that I know of where during the trial the press kept telling the jury how to vote, how to construe the evidence, and how to interpret the fact that evidence was missing as a factor supporting guilt. That has never happened since, and I'm sure was a factor in the Supreme Court's decision. On the other hand, the Minnesota case, the public certainly was told, here's your chance to get back at all the cops. Give this guy a real kicking, and it will atone for some of the bad things they've done to us in other unrelated cases. Well, that doesn't make any sense either.
You know, there was something very interesting the day the verdict came in. As soon as we knew the verdict was going to come in, there was about an hour that passed by, and groups were forming in Minneapolis. I believe a lot of the National Guard was on standby in a lot of states, that something bad could happen if the verdict were to be innocent or not guilty. What does that say to you? Did that have some impact on the case, in your opinion?
Well, I think it had an impact on the case because the fear was there before the trial, not when the verdict was in gestation. The problem is that people want satisfaction. They want revenge. They want tit for tat. And when a fellow gets as far as to be put on trial in a criminal court in the highest court of the state, and then is found to have been mistakenly accused, or at least not convicted because the evidence doesn't fully support that he did the bad things he's accused of, the public, like the magi of old, are all unsatisfied. They have no one to hang as a result of this terrible crime. And they're outraged, and they display that by showing officials and others how displeased they are that there has been a failure, because every acquittal is, in the minds of many Americans, a failure in the system. Their attitude is they wouldn't have brought him to court if he didn't do it.
When we turn to the case here just up the road in Columbus, Ohio, of 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant, this shooting happens the day of the Floyd verdict. There is a video here, too. Now, unlike the Floyd trial, this video shows 16-year-old Bryant with a knife. Did the police officer act correctly, in your opinion, in this case?
That case, I think, is not difficult. Its timing was unfortunate because it was subordinate to a much larger internationally watched case up in Minnesota. But the body cam there, to me, is a complete vindication. I would have fired the shot as quickly as he did, maybe more quickly, because whatever the girl in pink who was about to get that knife shoved into her gut had done, she hadn't been tried or convicted. And whoever decided to execute her did not deserve the opportunity to do so. I think that shooting is eminently justified, and much as the survivors of the gal who had the knife are bereaved, I think they've got to face the fact that their little girl was wrong, and you do have the right to kill someone who is about to kill an innocent third person. It's an extrapolation of self-defense. But it certainly is very much recognized over the years. I don't think that police officer can be criticized for what he did.
It's very interesting. If this had not happened on the day of the Floyd verdict, if this, what came after was the police chief in Columbus, Ohio, saying this has to be investigated by BCI. It was press conferences, and I believe, as a matter of fact, yesterday, Bryant's funeral arrangements were printed in the Columbus Dispatch, the biggest newspaper in Columbus, Ohio. What does all that...
I know it well.
Yeah, yeah. What does that all say to you?
Well, look, people are scrambling. Here, you've got a case being watched around the world where a cop has his knee on a man's neck, which most of us know is essential to breathing and therefore continued life. And he's got it there in an almost casual way for nearly 10 minutes. And while focused on that, we find a young girl being shot by a cop. I would assume the bullets hit her in the back, because that's the only vantage point I could see from the video that was on the news. So you've got a flip-flop here, maybe. Or you've got policemen gone wild, just shooting everybody they disagree with, depending on which camp you join. Unfortunately, people will gravitate toward the camp against the cop. And in this case, they would be, in my view, totally wrong. You cannot tolerate anybody wielding a knife and about to stab someone else if you've got the means to stop them. And the police officer did everything he should have done. I can't find anything he did that he shouldn't have done. But it's an uphill battle. It's like coming out the day after a hurricane and seeing a thunderstorm, which might, at the end of the day, be more than destructive, and saying, oh, my Lord, it's going on and on and on. I think people were bewildered, but that, among all of the contested cases, I think is the most clear, at least from the limited amount of information that I've been exposed to.
What has the world, where every cell phone has a video camera, done to trials? Clearly, the Floyd case was predicated on a video, or certainly the outrage. This thing in Columbus, how many times have we seen the video, the body cam, so on and so forth? How has that changed?
Well, yeah. I think video, body cams, and so forth are all to the good, except for the fact that we are becoming vegetables who can no longer remember our own phone numbers, because what the heck, I've got it in my cell phone. I can always look it up if I need to call myself. I mean, it's gotten that bad, and while human memory is a wonderful asset, it's being siphoned away by reliance on these little devices, which can do everything to tell you how to feel today, and I'm sure apps are being written that will help you out in that respect. But the biggest problem in American society, in my view, is the lack of any real concern about the truth. The truth always comes out in the same place if you pursue it correctly and with expertise. And I have been beating this drum ever since I first became involved with lie detectors back in 1954 as a Marine cop, so to speak. People think that the power to lie and the right to lie is the same. I mean, look at the claims made by our last head of state and his whole administration. They stole the election. Almost anything that they chose to say would be said without regard to the truth. So people are continually in turmoil for lack of what we call in the polygraph, the lie detector profession, we call ground truth. And that is essentially what a fly on the wall would have seen if he had a camera. And that's very helpful. I remember when John Gotti tried to hire me years ago, and an arrogant son of a bitch he was, he said, tell me what date we'll have the acquittal, and I'll arrange the party. And I said, John, I'm a pretty competent cross-examiner. I don't think I can help you in this case, because the worst witness in the case is you, talking about what you are authorizing people to do, and it's on video. How do you cross-examine a video of your own client giving it a legal order? At which point he made a terrible mistake. He said, well, do what you got to do. Sammy Gravano here will take a fall for me if necessary. I looked at Sammy. I said, uh-oh. And that night, Sammy called the FBI. He said, I'd like to be on your side.
What is an effective cross-examination? What do you need to have that?
Well, you know, I spend more time writing books and giving lectures and cross-examination than any lawyer presently alive. And it is a subtle, difficult, but invaluable tool. And it's not that easy to handle. And frankly, the number of really good cross-examiners in the U.S. today is limited and dwindling sharply, and it's too much work because we're phonies. We file all kind of lawsuits. We take about 2% of them, the trial. The rest is bluster, negotiation, shouting, and all this stuff, which, by the way, Zoom courtrooms may help attenuate a bit. But a good cross-examiner has an astounding memory and no notes. I have never taken a note to a podium in a courtroom or, frankly, to speeches for thousands of people. Because I say, if it isn't in your head, send someone else up to read your notes. What do they need you for? And furthermore, you've got to be able to be fast on your feet and counterpunch. A cross-examiner should never formulate a question until he hears the answer to the prior question. That takes some agility, some training. Doesn't mean it's difficult to do to the point where only a few people are born with the innate ability to develop that way, but it does mean it's a lot of work, and I haven't seen enthusiasm for a lot of hard work to be anywhere near at the levels it was when I was a kid. We were in the midst of World War II. We were patriots. We were going to go out and control the world and have taken large steps in that direction, and that has become somewhat flaccid. Now we spend as much time fighting with ourselves as we do Vladimir Putin and some of the outrages in the Middle East.
Police brutality has become a key term in a lot of these cases. Is that a real thing? And if so, what is real police brutality?
Police brutality of a physical type has greatly improved in the past 50 years. It used to be that if you disagreed with a cop on the street in Boston, he'd take out his club and give you 40 whacks. That is not in fashion anymore. We've got body cams, witnesses, and police being told, no, no, you can't do that. Of course, the people in the Rodney King film apparently hadn't received the message because they were there with their nightsticks giving Rodney 40 whacks. I think police brutality is part of the nature of the beast. I mean, you set people up as adversaries and then tell them, now, I want you all to really be fair to one another. Well, what kind of nonsense is that? That's like sending two prize fighters in for the heavyweight championship saying, I don't want you boys to hurt one another. That's not the nature of the game. And if the policeman is the adversary of the criminal suspect who potentially is a harm to society, he's not going to treat him very nicely. As a matter of fact, a shortcut to getting the information he wants is a little bit of brutality. That's hard to wean out of the system. I doubt there are any systems out there where it is totally cured. But I must tell you, in many countries that I've traveled to, particularly English-speaking Commonwealth countries, when it comes to the quickness of a policeman to use physical force or other measures which we might call brutal, we are at the bottom end of the scale. In most countries, the policeman would be frocked and in many cases put in prison for that kind of conduct. And we tend to say, well, Ron, I know he broke his skull open, but he didn't mean to do it. He was a nice boy. He just got over enthusiastic.
Do police officers across this country at this particular time, because of what we're going through, have to act differently than they have in the past?
I think police officers have to spend a lot more time being concerned about protecting themselves than they do about protecting and serving the people that they took an oath to protect and serve, because we have helped to make it that way, or at least to cause them to believe it. They're always on the defensive. The body cam is a wonderful weapon for them, as I think will prove to be the case in Columbus in that shooting, in the potential stabbing case, but it also is a damning vehicle to condemn the police officer's conduct, as in Minnesota, where we have that 9 minutes and 29 seconds of certainly very pronounced brutality. In part, I think it's the nature of the beast. You know, I was once told by a psychologist, a police psychologist, who said, when I test a fellow, if he comes out sociopathic, I can tell you one of two things. He's either a criminal or a cop. Well, I found that to be so in a limited sense, very limited. I've represented a lot of cops. I think it's a very honorable profession, and I think it's a difficult one, and sometimes put up in very bad circumstances where it's held to light in unpleasant views. I would not want to be a police officer or recommend to any of my colleagues or relatives and so forth. They do so because I also think it's a thankless job. We love the policeman. We give him an apple every day when things are smooth. But if something goes wrong, he's likely to be the blame and the target, even though he doesn't deserve it. We can't seem to rise to that level of cultural respect between law enforcement and those I might call the governed that you would find in England, Australia, New Zealand in particular, one of the best-run countries in the world, and others that seem to be more mature. We are still rabble-rousing to a far greater extent than we can justify after being around for 200 years to try and find out what's what.
Celebrity has become a big part of this whole episode in our time, and probably the biggest celebrity involved in this has been LeBron James. He's been very vocal on a lot of these issues, and after the incident in Columbus, he put up a tweet that he did end up taking down after the video was released. What do you make of LeBron James' activity in this time?
I think LeBron is like a bunch of people who run out of gas, in a sense, from being celebrities. Now, he's much heralded as a fellow who's one of the outstanding basketball players of history. And although we much revere our athletes and honor their memories, when you run out of gas playing basketball, the question is, what do you do next? Well, if you're John Elway, you buy the team that you played for and make them national champions. Most of the celebrities that I have come to know, and that's a fair amount, kind of flounder about wondering what they can do that is genuinely good for society. And I'll credit LeBron with having that in mind. He's frustrated by the fact that little progress has been made in better treatment between cops and citizens and blacks and whites, and he's using his name to beat the drum. And like most people who shift areas of expertise, he didn't get it right because he didn't do his homework. Now, normally we don't get to see these videos, but he was outraged at the thought of this young girl being shot the day after the Minnesota case had gone down in such, I may say, so bloody fashion up in Minneapolis. And he left before he leaked. But I give LeBron Gate credit, because most of the celebrities who make mistakes of that sort refuse to admit that they made the mistake. And he jumped in and said, okay, I was wrong, and I give him credit. I think it's good that people like LeBron use their recognition and the likelihood that people will listen to at least part of what they say to try to attack the things they think are wrong with our society, and particularly in the area of law enforcement. Therefore, I would give him a good grade on balance there, because he had the courage to say, okay, I made a mistake. In this case, the police officer was not wrong. I'll tell you, the troublesome case in the United States right now is not Minneapolis, it's not Columbus, Ohio, or any of the other potboilers that are perking up. We haven't seen erupt yet. It's the one in North Carolina. That, to me, may be one of the worst cases I've ever seen in 60-odd years of watching this program unfold. And shrouds are being hung over it, which befuddle me. I mean, my Lord, the little that we've seen of it looks like a wholesale massacre of a single defenseless man. And yet we don't see the FBI coming in and taking over and arresting everybody in sight. That is going to hold America up to a really bad image, bad everything I can think of, unless it turns out to be different than the suspected 7 policemen shooting guy who had both hands on the steering wheel.
Why do you think that's being kept off the radar in a certain way?
That's very puzzling. We know that the 7 police officers were suspended. We don't know why. It seems like they may have done the wanton shooting that they're accused of by the lawyer who saw a 20-second snippet, and apparently a very damaging 20-second snippet. Now, you've got the sheriff who wants it released, in part because I'm sure his innocent sheriffs want to be vindicated as not being part of whoever it was that put all those bullets into Mr. Brown. You've got the DA, and I don't think he's calling the shots, frankly, who won't release it, and the judge who has not been really quick to jump in and try to cure the problem. So everybody's wondering what's on the other tapes. Did these cops just stand there and fire willy-nilly into what was rapidly becoming a dead body? And if so, how did they get in uniform? How many more are wearing the same uniform? I mean, there's reason for panic there. On the other hand, our new Attorney General, Merrick Garland, is a very sensible guy and keeps a pretty sharp eye on things, I think, as a matter of policy from his many years of judge and in other legal roles. And if there was something there that were extraordinary, I have a sense the FBI would have come in. There's plenty of civil rights jurisdiction there if you wanted to, and exercised a heavier hand. Or we may find out down the road that everything is being kept shrouded in order to gather evidence against the guilty and in favor of the innocent and the FBI is sitting back there pulling the strings. I would say at the moment the world should fasten its attention on the Brown case in Elizabeth City until some answers are given, because there may be a lot to learn from what went on there.
Before we part ways here this morning, when LeBron James did make those comments and he took them down the day after the Columbus, Ohio shooting, O.J. Simpson made some news that day saying that LeBron should have waited before he put that video up. What did you make of O.J.'s comments?
Well, I think I just said essentially the same thing. LeBron didn't do his homework. And unfortunately in America, we tend to kick the football without looking first as to where it might go. And O.J. learned something in the many years of litigation I don't think he ever intended to be involved in. Bear in mind, O.J. and LeBron are almost identical. They're both leading heroes of their own sports who will be legendary for the performance, even though O.J. is going to be much maligned as a murderer for murders he had nothing to do with and didn't know about until long after other people did. He is a case that I hope will remain unique. It certainly is the most discouraging case in my experience, and yet my hat is off to O.J. He has come through all of this in the 26 years that I've been dealing with him with a great deal of equanimity, where I think if I were in his position, I would be so angry that I would just be looking around to see who I could hurt, because misery loves company.
How is O.J. today?
He's fine. I pick up the phone and talk with him every now and then. He hasn't commented on the manuscript I sent him on the book coming out in January. I mean in June, the truth about the O.J. Simpson case. But that's typical of O.J., and I'm sure he will say, well, you know, I've read it, and it looks okay to me. But I'll tell you one thing, he had nothing to do with writing it. History did that, and it is, unlike LeBron James, very, very well documented. There's nothing in that book I can't back up with a court record, and I don't do it with tweets.
We will look forward to that. F. Lee Bailey, probably the most well-known defense attorney in America and maybe around the world. Mr. Bailey, thank you so much for joining us this morning, and I hope you come back soon, maybe when the book is released.
Always a pleasure, Scott.
Thank you. Bye-bye. F. Lee Bailey, one of the best. All right, back in about 10 minutes.
WGH Radio, offering remote and on-site technical support, network setup, and computer troubleshooting for homes and businesses. Website pctech.biz or adamthecomputerguy.com. Telephone number 740-531-2326. Also available mobile notary services in Central and Mid-Ohio.
We here at WWGH Radio 107.1